Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. I know it's late, and I really want to thank you all for coming here. You get me first, and you get Romy in a second. This is our contact information. What we would like to do is four things this afternoon. One is in terms of the challenges that immigrants in these United States of America face in seeking access to healthcare and healthcare services, and in being healthy in general. We're going to reflect on some of the stuff that Maria and Melinda mentioned, and maybe try to provide some examples to you of the perspective of healthcare through the eyes of an immigrant living in these United States. And then based on that, really try to identify what some of the barriers to healthcare are. We are community health workers and promotores, and so we function where the rubber hits the road. And so this is not theoretical, but mostly giving voice to some of the experiences that we live. And then we'd like to consider some of the, Romy will present some of the strategies that she has applied to try to meet some of these challenges, and as enormous as they are, she has applied them to the management of chronic disease and presenting community health workers as a potential piece of the solution. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Oh, good. I think one of the first things that we want to mention is that the healthcare is viewed very differently in the United States from most of the rest of the developed world. When you think about healthcare, are folks in the audience here in public health, I would assume? Yeah? Can I see your hands? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. All right. So, when we think about health and public health, we think about, we have a purpose, right? And our purpose is generally, we want to impact the effectiveness and quality of services, right? We want to help people. We're servers, right? We serve community, we serve society, we serve people. Right, that's our philosophy, but when you start operationalizing, when we start operationalizing that purpose, we find that we run up across some really practical realities, right? And sometimes things like productivity show up and get in the way, and sometimes things like effectiveness, right, and cost benefit. And outcomes. We got to create outcomes, right? Everybody wants outcomes, right? And then it's sometimes that might challenge that original purpose that we had, right? Well, that's complicated enough, and there are certainly many forces that drive that dilemma. I know the fact that we fund healthcare categorically in these United States certainly drives some of that, right? The fact that we plan disease-focused interventions certainly contributes to some of that stuff. But there's another big influence on that here in the United States, and that's the fact that here, healthcare is bought and sold. That's what it is. That's what it always has been. It's a commodity. The rest of the world views healthcare actually as a basic human right. The developed world met, actually, in 1948. I was just a sparkle in my mother's eye, right? The leaders of the world gathered and made a declaration for the world about what health was. Does anybody remember what that? You all read it in Public Health 101, right? They said, and I'm gonna quote it because I don't want to mess this up. They said that health, the leaders of the world, 60 years ago, health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease. Nice, right? Yeah, they didn't stop there. You know what else they said? They said that this state of being was the basic human right of every human being. They declared the world 60 years ago that health was a basic human right, except in the United States. As recently as 3 weeks ago, some of you may have watched this show, by the way, two gentlemen who are wanting to be president of the United States were asked very directly by a moderator. They were asked, is healthcare a privilege a right or a responsibility. And in spite of the fact that the world had already declared this 60 years ago, only one of those two men responded that health was a human right, in spite of the declaration of the World Health Organization. So there are some things about a commodity that we should consider, right? For one thing, if you're managing a commodity, then the sale, the exchange, the sale and purchase of the commodity has to benefit you, right? I mean, if you're selling shoes, if it ain't to your benefit, then you need to get out of the business, right? No? Yeah. Okay, if you're selling ice cream or houses or bananas, if it's not benefiting you, then you need to find another lifestyle, right? Another job. Well, in a very real way, healthcare is the same way. If the practice of healthcare doesn't profit your organization, then you're in the wrong business. Because it's a commodity. You got it? I'm talking to you about alternative views, okay? There are people, you know, in these United States who have alternative views and different experiences from might be different from yours. And in some people's eyes, this is how healthcare is. It is a business and it is something that is bought and sold. And if it's something that is bought and sold, then it has to profit the seller. So in a way, healthcare has to benefit healthcare. It doesn't really have to benefit the client. Oh, that would be nice, but we don't need it because it's economically driven. Right? All right. The other big thing, and Melinda and Maria mentioned this stuff, is this national policy of fear. Not only is healthcare in this country a commodity that is bought and sold, but we also have an official national policy of fear. I don't know if you remember, but I don't know if you've noticed, actually, but over the same 8 to 10 years that my colleagues mentioned, the whole immigration discussion has really changed, right? I mean, we used to talk about undocumented folks, right? A hot 8, 10 years ago, we used to talk about undocumented people. That whole discussion quickly became illegal people. Not just illegal people, but illegal aliens. Yeah. And then that conversation has very recently progressed to criminal aliens. Right? So the whole, even the conversation, even the word, our language has become very poisoned and combative and confrontational and exclusionary. The whole language. And so how do you have a discussion? You wonder why this issue hasn't come up in this presidential debate? It hasn't come up because it's too poisoned. It can't be discussed right now. We've shifted as a culture where we can't even in any mature way discuss these issues because of the national policy of fear that we've instituted. And I'm going to quote to you the exact words that started this national policy of fear. It is when our leader said to the world, and I quote, "You are either with us or you are against us." And that on that day, a national policy for this country was established. And it's a policy of fear. It is a dualistic. Have anybody here studied human development, childhood development? You know about dualism and relativism, right? And our national policy of fear, which says that I am wrong and you are right. I am good, you are bad. I am patriotic, you are unpatriotic. I am American, you are un-American. That whole exclusionary dualistic policy has led to an environment, a cultural setting, where we really can't have intelligent conversations about these issues. And again, this is how I'm telling you how another side of the world views reality in these United States and views the healthcare system. This is actually in violation not only of World Health Organization declarations, but it's also in violation of United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is also a resolution issued in the same year, which guarantees safety and health to everyone in the world, but specifically talks about motherhood and how motherhood and childhood, and I quote the resolution, motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. This is a universal declaration by the United Nations. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protections as mothers. So motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. Okay? So I want to show you two examples. That same resolution back in 1948 also said, of course, that it was a basic human right not to be imprisoned without cause, which we all know that no longer exists. So what I'd like to do is just tell you two stories that occurred this year and that were published in the New York Times. One was published on July 20th, and these are very short summaries of these stories, but I'd like to read them to you because it reflects on the state of health, healthcare, and healthcare access in these United States. The first article published on July 20th of this year, just during this summer, is about a woman named Juana Villegas. This story starts when Juana Villegas, an illegal immigrant from Mexico, who was 9 months pregnant, was pulled over by a police officer in a Nashville suburb for a routine traffic violation. By the time Mrs. Villegas was released from county jail 6 days later, she had gone through labor with a sheriff's officer standing guard in her hospital room and one of her feet cuffed to the bed most of the time. County officers barred her from seeing or speaking with her husband, and after giving birth, her newborn infant, an American citizen, was taken from her and she was returned to jail. Mrs. Villegas, who is 33, had lived in the United States since 1996 and has 3 other children besides this newborn who are American citizens, because they were born here. She was stopped on July 3rd, the day before the celebration of our national independence. She was stopped on July 3rd in her husband's pickup truck by a police officer in a Nashville suburb, initially for careless driving. But after Mrs. Villegas told the officer that she did not have a license, which was actually pretty normal until very recently, he did not issue a ticket, as is normal practice, but rather arrested her instead. Mrs. Villegas' lawyer said that driving without a license is a misdemeanor in Tennessee and that police officers generally handle this with a citation, not an arrest. Upon her arrival at county jail, this is important to how healthcare is delivered today. Upon her arrival at county jail, federal immigration agents who were working there, La Migra was working at a local police office, a local police station. This is part of a cooperative agreement between the federal government and local law enforcement agencies. This federal agent conducted a background search on Mrs. Villegas, and it showed that she was an illegal immigrant and who had been deported from the United States in 1996 when she first arrived. She had no criminal record, but this cooperative program, which is called the 287G program, this program is actually aimed at screening for immigrant convicts, immigrants who have been convicted of crimes and who have served time. But in this case, in spite of the fact that Mrs. Villegas was not a criminal, to which this agreement would apply, immigration agents issued an order to take charge of her away from the local police department. So the federal government took charge of this woman. And once they did that, they labeled her a medium security risk to the security of the homeland. So a woman who was 9 months pregnant and jailed was declared a risk to this country, a medium security risk to the security of our homeland. Her lawyer said that Mrs. Villegas would never have been detained without this 287G agreement with the local law enforcement. So when Mrs. Villegas went into labor in jail the night of July 5th, She was handcuffed by the deputy and taken by ambulance to the hospital at Meharry. Arriving at the hospital in labor, her foot was chained to the hospital bed, the phone in her room was turned off, and she was not permitted to speak with her husband, even when he came to retrieve their newborn son from the hospital. 2 days later, after giving birth, she was released from the hospital and returned to jail. As Mrs. Villegas left the hospital, a nurse tried to offer her a breast pump, but the sheriff's deputy said she could not take any equipment into jail with her. So Mrs. Villegas was separated from her nursing newborn infant for the next 2 days while she was waiting for her court date. Her breast became infected, and her infant developed jaundice. I felt like I was being treated like a criminal person, Mrs. Villegas said. On July 8th, she was 4 days later, she was taken to court, 3 days after her arrest. She was taken to court where she pleaded guilty to driving without a license and was sentenced to time served. Immigration agents immediately released her so that she could be processed through a deportation proceeding. When questioned about why you would consider a 9-month pregnant woman a medium risk, the prison officials said that this was just because she was an illegal, a criminal alien, but apologized for the length of her delay. But they had to wait because we were celebrating Independence Day, and it was a national holiday in this country. I sort of quote this story because it's impactful and it's revealing to the fact that healthcare in the United States is a commodity and how easy it is to control a commodity. We know that if we want to limit access to something we're selling, it's a pretty easy thing to do. If you run a nightclub, just raise the cover charge, right? Keep the riffraff out. Right. If you're running a restaurant and you want to provide a certain ambiance, then just raise the price of your menus. Right. Or in fact, we could have some exclusionary policies that limit. Right. That limit access to whatever it is we're selling. I could, for example, have a men's club. It's that easy. I could just establish that as a criteria, and that limits your access to my commodity. Right. So it's a pretty easy thing to do. The one thing that I do want to mention, though, is that as a consequence of all of these policies and all of these situations that people experience, you know, a lot of this stuff doesn't get into the media. But it's funny because the Latino media seems to have access to stuff that other media don't. You should pick up some of these Spanish-speaking papers. They're amazing. They're incredibly resourceful. And so people know. You know, I mean, Maria and Melinda talked about, you know, people who are afraid to go outside and people who are... we have experienced those stories. We have men. I mean, I have men tell me, I kiss my daughter goodbye every day. Every morning, I kiss my daughter goodbye because I don't know if I'm coming back. I don't know if I'll be able to come home tonight. So I make sure that she knows that I love her and I kiss her every day. So how are you healthy? Remember what we talked about what health is? How are you healthy if that's the way you're living? Is it any surprise that we have like an enormous increase in mental health issues? Is that any? How is it possible to live under that kind of? All right, so that's obvious, but what are the other things that accompany living in a society of fear? One thing, for example, you have no identity. You cannot have a social security number, which means you cannot have an ATM card, you cannot have a credit card, you cannot have a phone in your name, you cannot have a rent, a lease in your name. So there's no way for you to establish any kind of security or safety for yourself or your family, because you're not allowed to have an identity. And what are the effects on esteem and self-worth when you're having to live like that? Of course, you do experience, and you know, because these are your friends, you see the stories in the paper, that there are random arrests, there are raids going on, there are disappearances. People know family and friends who have disappeared. It's not just rumor to them. It's part of their life experience. It's one thing for me to sit in New York and read about how 400 agricultural workers were arrested But it's quite another thing when you one of when your cousin is one of those, or you read it in your newspaper. That's a very different experience. There was also some reference to some of the hatred and violence and vitriol that people face in their daily lives, and people talk to us about that. How they're afraid to get on the subway because they can sense the explicitness of the hatred and the discrimination and the racism that people, and it is very explicit to many people. And so people talk about what it means to that. People talk about what it is to go to the doctor and get judged and blamed and labeled. Non-compliant is a big one people talk about. It really injures me as a human being to be told that I'm not compliant. That injures me. And so why would I come back here for a service if you've injured me? There's a real sense of abuse. This whole experience of having worked for a time and not get paid. Worked for a week, worked for 2 weeks, worked for a month. And then, when you ask for your payment, you say, oh, we can't pay you anymore, you're fired. And this is not a small scale or isolated incident. I mean, we know what happened in New Orleans where, thousands of workers were brought in and worked for a year and a half, and never got paid. And then were reported so they could be deported by their employer. So this is known. People know this. This is not a secret. So there is a fear of government. There is a fear of institutions. There is a fear of any kind of an authority, any uniform. It really doesn't matter. And I it's funny because I work. It's not funny, but I worked at a major medical center once, and they decided to build these CHCs when CHCs were getting built. And, they did all their homework, and they found out, CDC and everybody thought, asthma is the problem in this community. So they built this fancy asthma clinic, and they did a grand opening, a parade, and music, and nobody came. Nobody came. And it was nice, but nobody came. And so they asked us community health workers to go out and talk to people why nobody came. And nobody came because this was a brand new facility, and there was a security guard standing outside to protect it. And that's a uniform. And sorry, but people are not going to come and walk by a uniform to come into your fancy new building. And so all we had to do was put a suit on the guy instead of a uniform, and the place is packed. So this is so alien to us. There are many in this room here who might look at a uniform as a source of security and safety. And that's not always the case. There's a fear of illness. There's a fear of getting sick and a denial mechanism included in that. Becoming sick means you don't work. Becoming sick means you don't get paid. Becoming sick means if you don't show up at work, you get fired. Becoming you don't get sick days. That's not usually the norm. And so becoming sick is a very scary thing. The idea of having to purchase medicines is completely beyond many people's means. And so the whole concept of going to the doctor and seeking care and getting told that you're either uncompliant or sick is a very fearful experience for many people. And then lastly, there's this whole fear of retribution. Retribution and the effect on your application for residency. In many people's experiences, if you use government services, you pay. One way or the other, sooner or later, you're going to pay somehow. And it doesn't necessarily have to be money, but you will suffer some consequences. And then your health status could impact your application for residency. We all know that if you're HIV positive, you are denied. Anybody who's HIV positive is denied entry to this country. We know that, right? But I don't know if you knew that. If you have syphilis, you're also denied. If you have gonorrhea, you're also denied access to this country. And if you have tuberculosis, you cannot enter this country. And so people do come in here, and if you could go get checked for something, and somebody finds out you got syphilis, and sorry, you gotta go. So that's a very realistic fear for people. So, it ain't no fun, right? Okay, so these are the realities of people. So you might ask, well, does anybody here work in chronic disease management? Asthma? Yeah? Diabetes? Nutrition? Any maternal child health folks? No? Okay. Well, so I'm going to ask Romy to talk for a few minutes about how she has been able to use some strategies to help people who are not documented access some healthcare services in her medical center in Brooklyn.
Thank you, Sergio. Hello, everybody. My name is Romelia Rodriguez, and I work at Woodhull Hospital, and my boss is in the audience. So in asthma care management, we have many official guidelines, and if you see in this slide, we have all these guidelines for hospital and clinics and doctors and nurses and schools and housing and children. And so in general, guidelines are created to provide better and standard asthma management. These guidelines also provide suggestions for developing asthma interventions and appropriate goals and outcomes. And these are the typical asthma care goals. You know, those include patients partnered with physicians, patients in control of their asthma, full life, decrease of ER visits, decrease of hospitalization, decrease of school and work absenteeism. But does the client share these goals? Are they even interested in these goals? And especially if you live under these conditions that, you know, our colleagues just described, you know, it might, a person have, you know, the people might have other priorities. So, the reality is that there is a tension between program goals and the needs of our clients. You know, the programs have goals, and those are like keeping your appointments, treatment adherence, reduce ER visits and hospitalizations, and attend our workshops. I just went to a statewide meeting before I came to the APHA, and it was a three-day meeting. And the most popular presentation was this presentation that, you know, people were so... They were so excited. They were applauding about this presentation, and people were talking about it in the hallways. It was the most popular presentation. And the presentation included a demonstration of an 8-minute asthma education for patients. 8 minutes. And this session covered what is asthma, asthma physiology, different asthma medications, how to use a spacer, an MDI, all of these in 8 minutes. So this was the goal of the program. And it was presented as a best practice in this meeting. So programs have goals, as I said, but people and families might have other priorities. And we might consider those priorities. They just not might be worried about your efficiencies. They are concerned with survival. You mentioned employment, food, housing. They have their own personal values and norms. For example, people in the ER always tell me that they love the emergency room. That's why they go so much. They love it because it's fast. They don't have to make an appointment. They just love the doctors in the emergency room. So, and they if they live under the socioeconomic reality that, you know, Sergio described and in this immigrant experience, imagine. So they have their own beliefs and behaviors. Also, I have people who come to the hospital and tells me that they love albuterol because it's fast, because it works immediately, you know, they see the effect, and others have told me that they think asthma is in their throat or in their heart. All, you know, I hear them all. I have a lot of examples, but we don't have time right now, I know. So in spite of all this disconnection between the program goals and the family priorities, many programs keep doing the same thing, expecting different results. So based on our experiences with immigrants population, with immigrant populations, we try a different approach and hoping to get different results. So we shifted the focus of our intervention from program first to client first. Having changed our approach, we then implemented popular education methods. This combination gave us a improved self-management among the people in our program. So the client-first approach is a strength-based approach, places the client first, shifts perspective from faults to strengths, strengths assessment first, and needs assessment second. It provides for trust and rapport because it's authentic. It provides for dignity and respect. And this improves self-esteem. It also helps recognize their own abilities and power. You know, Dr. Fishkin always tells me to tell the patients, if you don't like your physician, fire them. You know, we empower the patients to know what their rights are and to empower them through education as well. Support successful behavior changes. And this approach considers what is strong versus what is wrong. You might ask yourself, how do I do all of that? It's actually not so complicated. It's very easy. Like arriving on time, arriving before the client comes to see you. I greet a client. I escort them to the office. I get prepared with my encounters. I know their name, their conditions, the names of the children, and I ask permission to talk to them and to complete a form. I ask permission. I ask them how long do they have to spare with me, if this is a good time to talk to me, and I do not allow interruptions from any colleagues, from anybody who's passing by. I just, all my attention is to the patient. Also, I'm aware of my body language, and I check my body language. And also, I ask questions to find out what they already know about asthma since they are living with this condition. So, we meet those challenges in the spirit of popular education. So we help people examine themselves critically. We help people understand their condition. We help people identify their strengths. We help people develop their own goals. We help people develop their own strategies and reasonable and achievable. We help negotiate goals and strategies with those of the program. And we help maintain behavior changes by providing convoy of support. This approach is participatory and experiential, so no PowerPoint, no lecturing. It is a process of discovery, not force. You have to take this medication, otherwise you'll suffer these consequences. It's not force. We promote, these methods promote critical thinking and no demeaning. Changes the relationship from service to empowerment. And that leads to self-management. So, let me tell you about community health workers. This is an official definition of community health workers. It was developed by community health workers themselves on a national level. notice some key words in this definition. I trust. CHWs enjoy the trust of their communities. This trust gives us a unique and unprecedented access to our communities. Community health workers play a distinctive role in bridging gaps between health and social services in the community. So I want to draw your attention also to the footnote and the fact that this is a national recognized definition accepted by the U.S. Department of Labor as a standard occupational category. So like any other practice, we have multiple qualities. Community health workers have qualities, skills, and knowledge. And these are some of the qualities. But please, let me draw your attention to the first quality listed here. Share life experiences with community being served. Community health workers have faced and overcome challenges and barriers to the health similar to others in our communities. For example, I am from Peru. I came here when I was 20, and I know how to survive in this country. And I know what it is to survive without a social security and being undocumented and be treated like a stupid person because you don't speak the language. I know how to get healthcare services without insurance. I don't know if you want to know too much about this, but we can talk after the meeting. But I know. And because I know, I can help others with similar experiences and try to help them overcome their challenges. Community health workers have also many skills. Okay. One really important skill is that we help people change. Many doctors visit involve asking the patient to change. Many doctors think that they just have to tell people to do something and they will do it. Let me tell you a secret. They don't do what you tell them. Community health workers help people embrace healthier lifestyle choices through informal counseling, advocacy, and service coordination skills. So it is a happy thought that community health workers can do this. And also, and that's my last slide, that we have different roles. Community health workers also have many, many roles, but just let me point out to three of them. Cultural mediation between communities and the health and social service system, which includes engagement, you know, we do outreach, includes retention and system navigation. Also, culturally appropriate health education, which includes interpretation, translation, cultural and linguistic appropriate, follow-up and advocacy. And the third one is assuring people get the services that they need, which includes improved access, advocacy, extending the site of care from the clinic, hospital, to home environment. And third, interpret and negotiate the treatment plan between the provider and the patient. And Sergio is going to talk about community health workers' effectiveness.
Thank you, Romy. If there are questions amongst you about the effectiveness of community health workers, let me just say that there's a bunch of literature out there. About 12% of the United States population is actually made up of immigrants, so this is not an insignificant issue. As Maria and Melinda very eloquently said, this is a major concern to everybody. There are some issues around implementing CHW programs. Excuse me. And if you have those, we'd be happy to speak to you later. I don't have time to talk to you about this Confucius quote, but the quote from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King is relevant here, and he was very clear in many of his speeches when he said that of all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and the most inhumane. And so I would reiterate that, and that is not to say, we're not suggesting to you that immigration has ever been easy in this country. The whole issue of immigration has always been a very difficult experience, but it's always one that there were opportunities and hopes to survive from. We've actually created institutions and structures which prohibit that in this current environment. We also invite you to consider your program priorities and your goals and the fact that they might differ from those of your client. And program perspectives and expectations might be different from people's realities, and you might be actually very disconnected. And then lastly, to consider who is your program and methods really serving. Is it serving you? Is it serving your organization, your funder? Or is it the client that's being served? And lastly, to consider community health workers, most people's experiences, that they're part of the solution. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you both. Heard of 8-minute ads, but never 8-minute ads. So in haste, we're trying to cram a lot of good information here in a short session. So I'll immediately introduce our next presenter, Maria Ortega. She's currently a cultural and linguistic services specialist in the HealthNet, at HealthNet of California, and she is responsible for covering the Central Valley region. Ms. Ortega has over 14 years of experience working in the health and social service field. She's worked in program development at the California Endowment and worked in research and community-based projects at the National Institutes for the Occupational Health and Safety and Health. There she helped develop bilingual health and safety education materials, among other things. Ms. Ortega holds an MPH degree from the University of California, Los Angeles. Ms. Ortega, thank you.